Thanks for listening to this show from Aspen Public Radio. Archive podcasts, news, and more are made available thanks to the support of listeners like you. To make a donation of support, log on to aspenpublicradio.org. And thanks.
This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the artists and music behind the 2013 Aspen Music Festival and School. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival, and it can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Good afternoon. My name is Matt Erickson. Today's guests are conductor David Robertson and pianist Orly Shaham, who will preview their separate performances this weekend at the Aspen Music Festival. Musical collaborators, as well as husband and wife, Robertson and Shaham, have long been part of this festival. Robertson is currently the music director of the St. Louis Symphony, and Shaham is about to release a new CD of Jewish melodies, performed with her brother, violinist Gil Shaham. On today's show, we'll talk about music education, Stravinsky, and much more. Stay tuned. Welcome to Festival Showcase. My guests right now are pianist Orly Shaham and conductor David Robertson. Welcome to the Aspen Public Radio Studios.
Thank you.
Now, Orly, you were here last year, and Orly and David, you were both here the year before that. I know that many people are aware of the Aspen lore, the fact that you met here in Aspen. You got married, or
well,
I should say...
We got engaged here in Aspen.
That's right.
We didn't meet here, but we got engaged here.
You got engaged here in Aspen,
and in
publicly.
And in fact, if I may interrupt you, we had a wonderful moment this past Sunday when Yefim Bronfman played the Bartok Third Piano Concerto remarkably well. And we were both sitting there, and we suddenly both had this realization that I guess it would have been 11 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I was probably the last pianist to play the Bartok Third Piano Concerto here at the Aspen Music Festival. And when I walked off stage, right backstage, David proposed.
That's right. The orchestra manager had the ring. And so I gave her the ring at that point. And luckily, I nailed the ending, so she said yes.
but I got really worried on Sunday because I think FEMA played it better. And I was wondering if David was going to propose to him.
But I didn't have the ring organized, okay. So, you know, we're okay.
Was this a public engagement? Was it on stage or was it backstage?
The engagement was backstage.
It wasn't
backstage.
But
we were all a little bit excited. And
plus, it was Schumann Symphony No. 2, and that much C major at the end means that you do kind of tend to share your good spirits.
So David did announce it to the whole audience at the end of the symphony.
Marvelous.
And then, you know, I went up for one of those Hollywood movie kisses and realized that the side of my dress that had the slit on it, which usually I keep on the orchestra side, so not the audience side, was suddenly on the audience side. And there I was doing a real 1940s Hollywood kiss with a big slit on the dress all the way up.
There are a lot of Aspen romances here. I think of Edgar Meyer and his wife, Connie. I think of so many other musicians. What is it about this place that gets people together, you think, romantically?
You know, I think it's also just the fact that it's such an amazingly beautiful spot. And so you are primed to recognize beauty, whether that is in various different forms of nature or in other human beings. And certainly you recognize the inner beauty of musicians when they're performing. I mean, this is one of the things when you come here, not only for us, but also this fabulous combination of professional musicians and aspiring musicians being side by side, because that's the kind of interaction that you don't find very often. There are not a lot of music festivals or even places of learning where that kind of real co-partnership in music production is mm-hmm. prevalent. And so that's one of the things that impressed me right at the start. It's almost 20 years ago that I was in Aspen for the very first time, and that struck me more forcefully than almost any other thing, which is, you know, given the surroundings and the wonderful quality that Aspen has in and of itself, is a very striking thing.
I have to say, David's answer is very eloquent, but I think it's the lack of oxygen.
Makes us do some irrational things.
That's
is that
it.
Well, let's preview what's going on this weekend. Saturday, Orly, you'll be doing a recital at Harris Concert Hall, really interesting program that includes works by Brahms and a new work by Bruce Adolph. And we may know Bruce Adolph here from Fred Child Show,
Performance Today,
in which we often have that piano puzzler. You know, but I don't know if people realize that Bruce Adolph's music his classical music is very serious.
He's an incredible intellect and an incredible human being. He was actually my theory teacher when I was at pre-college at Juilliard. And there are all sorts of connections with this program that I'm doing on Saturday. I was playing through the Brahms Quintet just now and just kind of practicing. And I was looking at the page where I have the harmonic analysis which we did in Bruce's class when I was maybe 16 and we were studying Neapolitan chords and Brahms's use of them. Mm. And so actually I've been kind of on a major Brahms kick, especially late Brahms. And I'm in the middle of a recording project of doing the last four opuses and pairing them with works that inspired Brahms as well as works that were inspired by him. And some of those works that were inspired by him are commissions. Now, the very first commission is this piece that I'll be playing Saturday night, Bruce Adolph's Intermezzo, which is subtitled My Inner Brahms. And I just knew he would be the one to ask. You know, his understanding from a compositional perspective of how Brahms's thought process must have gone is so wonderful. And the piece, I'm loving it more and more as I get to know it, but it just captures so many aspects of Brahms's thinking as a composer.
Why at this stage of your life you're so interested in music of Brahms, the late music by Brahms?
Well, it's an interesting question. I don't think it's at this stage of my life. I think I've always been interested in it, and I think maybe I finally have the combination of the little bit of courage that it takes to approach it in public and the feeling that, you know, life is short, and if I don't do it now, I may never get to it.
And these CDs are going to be released on which label?
The best label out there, Canary Classics, owned and run by Gil Shaham.
That's right.
Keeping it in the family.
And I should also say for our listeners that you too have a new CD out, Hebrew Melodies, on the same label.
Yes.
And tell us a little bit more about this project.
Nigunim, which is a Hebrew word meaning sort of playings or things that are played. A lot of these are very famous pieces from the standard sort of Jewish violin-y repertoire, the Joseph Achron and the Baal Shem Suite by Bloch, pieces that, you know, even if you think you don't know them, you already do, and that we remember our grandparents humming along the house, you know, in these kind of very Yiddish syllables. You know, they would sing like bim bam boim bam, like that kind of that kind of sound, and it has some of those. And again, as part of our whole way of thinking of making sure the music lives today, we also wanted to commission a new work of Jewish music. And one of my favorite young composers out there is, I say young, but he's my age, Avner Dorman, wonderful Israeli composer who's living in the States. And he is a pianist. And I just knew that commissioning from him would mean that we would get a piece that was incredible for both the violin and the piano. Again, an intellect that is hard to surpass. And he wrote a piece that we could not be more thrilled with. It is just incredibly powerful and rhythmically captivating. Once you start listening to it, you won't want to stop.
And the piece is titled by Avner Dorman.
And in fact, that piece, which is technically his third sonata, is titled Nigunim. So we've called the whole album Nigunim.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Festival Showcase on Aspen Public Radio. My name is Matt Erickson, and my guests today are conductor David Robertson and pianist Early Shaham, who will be performing separately this weekend at the Aspen Music Festival. Now, Gil played here earlier this summer. Last summer, we had the great opportunity of hearing you both together. But not this summer. I think he's off where Ravinia or Tanglewood right now.
I think Saratoga. Okay. Or something.
But this is still a family affair. Now you have two children. Is that right? Here in Aspen.
It's even more complicated than that.
Okay. How's that?
Well, we have my oldest boy from a previous marriage, Peter, who's with us, and then we have Alex and Nathan, who are coming up to 6 years old, and they're presently at ACES having camp. So that's why we had a little bit of free time to come in here. And then we have Orly's mother is with us as well this week. So it's a nice sort of thing. We try and make sure that there's enough Shaham Robertson contingent in Aspen throughout the entire music festival.
Yeah, and in fact, this year we timed it so either perfectly or terribly, depending on how you want to look at it, that we literally did not overlap with Gil and Adele and their family at all. We missed them by one day. Okay. So they were here the whole first half of the summer, and we're here for the next 2 weeks.
Can you share with our listeners if your children are musical, or do they play instruments?
I'm afraid the bug is genetic.
Is that right?
It's hard not to be musical around our household, okay. I'm afraid. And it expresses itself in different ways. What's so fascinating is to see both Orly and I are passionate about how little children really relate to music. We both think that music education is something that is incredibly important just in the development of the whole person. And so I guess in a sense, we're kind of experimenting on our own, you know.
For sure.
Little guys, just to see what it is. But, you know, it's one of the things you see in reams and reams of neurological research, just how much the brain as a plastic entity really benefits from on-hands music making. Mm-hmm. And this, at any age, we've seen that even people who take up instruments late in life get extraordinary benefits in terms of how the brain is really just rebuilding and regenerating all sorts of different parts of itself. And of course, for little children, it's the best way to really sort of build the whole person and to develop all sorts of things which you use in many areas that are not at all connected with music.
And I should say, Orly, this morning you had your Baby Got Bach program here in Aspen, and it's in its fourth season. You also have productions of it in New York City and in St. Louis. You know, one question I often have is, I'm sure you're probably asked the same question, what is the right age to introduce an instrument to a child?
I do get asked that question all the time, and there are two different answers. One is, it really depends on your child, and their skill level, and as I'm learning from my kids, just their motor skills, you know, their fine motor skills and what they're able to do, because you don't want to introduce it before they're ready. That will lead only to frustration. So that's the sort of the physical question of when to introduce the instrument, sort of when their hands are ready and they're able to concentrate for a few minutes at a time. But my real answer to that is the minute they're born. You know, the very first toys I got my kids were instruments. The first 2 years we had, we didn't get any Thomas or anything till much later, but we had maracas and
the
cymbals.
The things that people forget are when the fetus is actually in the womb at 12 to 13 weeks, the inner ear, the hearing system of the human organism is fully developed, which to me is one of the most miraculous things. Mm-hmm. So sound is the first real determinant for experience in a young child. And this continues, and of course they can follow the way in which the voice is moving, the inflections, far earlier than they can pick up words. And of course this sense of inflection is precisely what makes up music. I mean, this is the bones of, you know, the modulation of the voice going higher and lower and taking time for certain things. These are all things that they're extremely susceptible to right at the start. So any kind of connection, whether it's beating on a drum or honking on some sort of little whistle, is, you know, all part of this amazing development.
And the other question I'm sure you're asked, what is the right instrument for my child? And I know in some cases, maybe some parents want their kid to be a pianist, but I mean, you have to let them choose on their own. Is that right?
You know, it's a combination. Our kids have just started school in New York at an incredible little public school called the Special Music School, where all the kids play some sort of an instrument, starting at age not quite 5.
Wow.
Necessarily, because it's starting in kindergarten.
Well, I'm sure they're not playing oboe or trombone.
Well, although they do start clarinet, but they start with recorder, and then by the end of the year, maybe move on to clarinet. And, you know, with our boys, it was very clear. One of our sons clearly has the pianist brain, whatever that means. He just gets the keyboard in a way that's very natural. Not to say by any means that he's the more musical one. Mm-hmm. Definitely not. And they're musical in very different ways. But the piano as a thing,
just the instinctive sense of how this works and how you can find pitches on it and how they relate and what you do with your hands, all of that was just clear.
Whereas the other son was clearly a string player. We could just feel that, the way that he would gravitate to string instruments, and, you know, by just kind of letting him feel them out. What we did, and not all parents have this luxury, but it was a wonderful thing, is when they were 4 years old, for 1 year, we had a wonderful early childhood music teacher come into our house once a week for about an hour, and she would let them choose what instrument they want to work on that day. And she had a cello, she had a violin, and they got a little of piano instruction, and she had a recorder. And as the year developed, they basically just got exposed to all of these. We never practiced, we never talked about it outside of that time they had with her. But by the end of that year, we had a pretty good sense who's going to do what. Now, our pianist may also have some lungs on him, so we'll see. He may, there may be a trumpet in our future, too.
The other question I have is, what time or what age should kids go to concerts, such as the Music Tent? Can they go at age 3 or 4 and have the attention span for 2 hour experience?
You know, it really depends on your child. We had a great experience with our sons. Were they 3?
Yeah.
When they heard the Pastoral Symphony in the back of the tent and amazingly sat totally still for 4 movements.
That's right. And the only downside was when it was over, the amount of crying that it was over was just so touching, you know, because it's like, no, we're coming into the coda. No, say it ain't so.
At the same time, they've also been in concerts since where they, you know, it's a little too much for them to really sit through. So you have to know your own child, and you can't push it. The last thing you want is for them to feel like, oh, this is something I'm doing for mom or dad. Mm-hmm. This needs to be something they do for themselves.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Festival Showcase on Aspen Public Radio. My name is Matt Erickson, and my guests today are conductor David Robertson and pianist Early Shaham, who will be performing separately this weekend at the Aspen Music Festival. Let's go to Sunday's concert, speaking about the Music Tent. And David, you'll be leading the Aspen Festival Orchestra and Beethoven's Triple Concerto and Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. Interesting combination here, Beethoven, Stravinsky. Was this your idea of programming?
Well, it was partly just due to the plethora of amazing soloists that they have here in Aspen. We managed to get 3 at one go, which is always a good sort of proportion to keep.
Violin, cello, and piano.
That's right. And then I actually really like putting Beethoven and Stravinsky in close proximity, because there's a great deal of the rhetoric of Beethoven that Stravinsky picked up on. This way of, you know, you only need to think of, say, the Eroica Symphony, where you have that passage with the really dissonant chords in the first movement. Yum, bum, 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 bum. Speed it up a little bit, and you have the Argus of Spring of yum, bum, 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 bing, bum, 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 bum. So there's that kind of, I'm going to bang my fist on the table now, ladies and gentlemen, that both Beethoven and Stravinsky learned to do in quite a remarkable way. Mm.
There's certainly an obsessive quality to Beethoven's music. Do you see that in Stravinsky's music as well?
You know, it's interesting because they were both extremely creative people, but both extremely rational. We know that Beethoven, in a sense, would second-guess himself all the time in his sketches. You know, he would have an idea, and he would then work almost with it like a sculptor, chipping away at various different intervals or at various different rhythms until he had precisely the form of the music that he wanted. So it feels, although I'm sure he was using his whole brain, a very much directed, conscious, prefrontal cortex kind of approach to composition. And Stravinsky, having been trained in the footsteps of Rimsky-Korsakov, whose first orchestration book is just a compendium of how to literally put every single chord with every single type of woodwind and brass combination and strings, Stravinsky contained this tremendous fantasy that he had in this extraordinary rational, within these extraordinary rational boundaries. And you can see this recently. They have, for the 100th anniversary of the Rite of Spring, which was, of course, first performed in 1913, the Paul Zacha Foundation, as well as the publishing company Boosey & Hawkes, has come out with an absolutely beautiful edition of a facsimile of the original handwritten score of Stravinsky's.
I think you can see that online as well.
And then the four-hand piano version, also in Stravinsky's handwriting, as well as a very large tome called The Avatar of Modernity, which is a series of essays looking at all sorts of different aspects of the Rite of Spring. And you can see when you look at Stravinsky, and I have studied the sketches, which were published in the 70s, and I got a copy of that and have pored over them, how he's also, like Beethoven, working to get things into exactly the right shape. And what's so fabulous, both about Beethoven and Stravinsky, is that once those things are in the right shape, they feel as though they have somehow been dictated from some eternal place of truth. And you cannot imagine them any differently. And what's been fascinating for me in studying these scores is to see that actually this notion of the authentic Rite of Spring, where this is what it really should be, does not exist. It is much closer to something like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, where when you get down to the subatomic level, you can more or less say certain things and talk about probabilities, but you can't exactly pinpoint something and say, here's where it is, because there were changes Stravinsky was making during the rehearsals and because of the different scores that were there, a copyist score, the one Montu was working on, and then the various different revisions that Stravinsky made to the piece when he no longer had the manuscript in his possession, so around the Second World War. All of these things mean that there are various different Rite of Springs, and you can talk about them almost as a field of the Rite of Spring rather than some authentic way of having the piece in all of its truth. Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting thing because, of course, this is where you get to when you're performing a piece of music. In any case, I think that because of the early music movement, there's been this misnomer about the idea of authenticity, and it can be a liberating concept in the sense that you learn more about lots of aspects of the music, and you don't necessarily take your own standpoint at your own period of time and the aesthetics of that time for granted. Mm. Yet at the same time, it can be very restrictive because all of a sudden everyone reduces it to, I want to have the real authentic version of this as though you were buying a Gucci or a Prada bag. And music is not a consumable in this way. Music is an experience you have, and so it's not as though we're doing covers of these pieces. We're actually going in and exploring all sorts of connections that the composers have put there, and these are constantly changing, whether we like that or not.
I love the idea of the Rite of Spring remix, though.
It's been done before and will continue to be done forever.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Festival Showcase on Aspen Public Radio. My name is Matt Erickson, and my guests today are conductor David Robertson and pianist Early Shaham, who will be performing separately this weekend at the Aspen Music Festival. Well, we have a number of recordings of Stravinsky conducting this piece, and I'm just curious, with this being the centennial year, you mentioned that, has your interpretation of this work evolved over time?
You know, it evolves every time. I've done it now with maybe 12, 13 different orchestras. Some of those orchestras I've done it with more than once on separate occasions, as will be the case with Festival Orchestra, where I did it in the mid-90s here and will now be returning to what is essentially the same orchestra. And this is, of course, the interesting thing, because very few of the professional musicians are the same ones, mm-hmm. and all of the students are different. So the name of the orchestra is precisely the same. We're playing in a tent which has been completely remodeled and acoustically changed. And so here you have this notion of sameness, and yet it's different. So even if I were to try and do the same things that I did in the 90s, unless I had some sort of tunnel vision or tunnel hearing, I would not be reacting to what it is I'm getting from the musicians. Mm-hmm. So there are certain things that I see in the score that I need to make sure to maintain, certain balances that we need to hear in a hierarchy of a complex texture. What is it that we can perceive, and what can the really deep listening audience member pick up. I want to make the score as clear as possible. At the same time, I want to leave the inspiration. If I have Scott Andrews playing first clarinet, whom I know very well from St. Louis, or if I have Brinton Smith playing the cello solo, I want to know what he thinks about that cello solo, because Brinton will bring world-class expertise of the cello in every single aspect of what the cello means in Stravinsky's music, in Russian music, in classical music, right across the board. He will bring all of that to the way he plays a little solo of one bar. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to come in and a priori say, well, actually, this is how it goes. Because somehow for me, that means that you lose the extraordinary creativity that an orchestra represents.
So Stravinsky is chamber music. You do have a piano background. Am I right in saying that?
No. Actually, no. In my household, we have a professional to do this.
I was going
to
ask you if you folks did the two-piano arrangement of Rite of Spring, but obviously not.
No, but we have played the three-hand version of the Stravinsky easy pieces.
Stravinsky wrote some pieces for Diaghilev, who also had no background, but wanted to play something and was very bad.
The impresario.
So I have actually played the simple part on that, while Orly has played the real part.
And I think, you know, although David can read a score faster and better than anybody in the family, I'm afraid the one who's been studying piano now for a year starting to have better two-hand control.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Very definitely.
Can you comment on the piano part for the Beethoven Triple Concerto? How does it compare with the five piano concertos or the piano sonatas?
It's nasty.
Is it really? And I should say, Inon
will be playing it, and I'm sure he's going to do a great job. And you've got Stefan Jakiv, who I actually played with last summer.
That's right, the violin.
Playing
Mozart.
The violin part. And, you know, it's tricky. It's all these finger twisters, and they go backwards and upside down and twisted. And every time I come back to that piece, I think, oh, I've played it a million times. I don't need to practice too much. Mm-hmm. And then I think, I should have left more time for this, which I think is basically how all pianists feel about that. And then the hardest part about that whole piece is, where do you put the musicians? And in fact, it was the cellist Brinton Smith who said the only solution is rear view mirrors.
Oh. Because in terms of sight lines, you mean?
Right.
Well, it's a combination of sight lines and hearing lines.
Yeah.
Because where you can see all the musicians, all the soloists, you can't hear all three. And where you can see the conductor, you can't necessarily hear the orchestra. Mm. So there's no brilliant solution. And unfortunately, each stage also makes sort of its own problems. And we pianists, you know, we have this unwieldy 9-foot instrument.
And you're used to all the attention usually when you're on stage doing a piano concerto. It's just you and the orchestra, and sharing it with a violin and cello, that's kind of a rare experience.
I actually love playing it because I love chamber music anyway. And this is sort of, it forces the chamber music aspect of it to the concerto. I mean, when I'm playing a Mozart concerto, a Beethoven concerto, anyway, I'm thinking about the chamber music within between me and the members of the orchestra. Mm. But the fact that there is this group there, I think, sort of forces that that way of thinking upon everybody who's on stage, which is really nice.
Well, we have so much to look forward to this weekend. We have Saturday, Orly Shaham, 8 p.m., Harris Concert Hall.
Yep.
And we'll hear chamber music as part of that concert. And then Sunday, David Robertson will be leading the Aspen Festival Orchestra and Beethoven's Triple Concerto and Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. Marvelous weekend look forward to. I want to thank you both for coming to the Aspen Public Radio Studios.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Festival Showcase here on Aspen Public Radio. If you've missed any portion of this program, you can hear it online at aspenpublicradio.org. My name is Matt Erickson. Please join me again next week for another set of interviews from the Aspen Music Festival and School. All Things Considered is next.
Thanks for listening to this show from Aspen Public Radio. Archive podcasts, news, and more are made available thanks to the support of listeners like you. To make a donation of support, log on to aspenpublicradio.org. And thanks.